The following podcast is a live recording of a radio show first broadcast by Fresh FM with assistance from New Zealand On Air.
Kia ora everybody and welcome to today's episode of Climate Matters. Before we get started on that, I just want to send my best wishes and aroa to the people of Tasman who've been hammered a couple of times with dreadful rain events. I hope this doesn't seem a bit too late, but these recordings, these episodes are often recorded a couple of weeks ahead of the broadcast date. And therefore, while it might be topical when I'm saying this, it might seem a little late when you're listening to it on the radio. So anyway, deep compassion really for the people of Tasman who've been hammered not once but twice, as everybody knows, with just unimaginable impacts and all human and agricultural and all sorts of other environmental ways. Okay, so I'm Lindsay Wood. I'm the director of climate strategy company Resilience Limited, and Climate Matters is brought to you by Fresh FM, the top of the South's community access radio station. Today, we're going to go into the ICJ special issue of Climate Matters. ICJ stands for the International Court of Justice. And the reason that we're doing a special on this is that just a few days ago, that court came down with a most striking, what is known as an advisory opinion to the United Nations. Now, the ICJ is the world's highest court, and the findings that they reached have enormous implications for us. So here's what we'll be covering. We'll be covering the International Court of Justice. What is it and why are we doing a special? What is their advisory opinion? Or to say that again, why is their advisory opinion such a big deal? A little bit of a story about how it came about from 27 Pacific law students right through to the world's highest court. What was the ICJ asked to address? How did they respond? And how might we look on their response? And then we'll close off with a word from Ralph Regan Vanu, who is Vanuatu's special climate change and environmental envoy to the United Nations. So I do hope you get lots about it out of it. We'll also close off with a little comment on the coming local government elections from a climate point of view. I'm going to try and put in a snippet each broadcast between now and the local government elections over the next couple of months. And so, except for ones where they've already been pre-recorded and I haven't done that. So anyway, let's get into it and let's see what the special issue of Climate Matters had to say. Climate Matters ICJ special, a sensational lifeline to the world. This is a big deal, is how I framed it in the Substack post. And let's take a really slow, deep breath and really try to feel the significance of this very profound advisory opinion that the court has expressed. It was on the 23rd of July in The Hague in the Netherlands, and the world's highest court was asked to give an advisory opinion on, and I'm quoting, obligations of states in respect of climate change. The full opinion, we'll give a link to the full opinion. I'm not pressing you to look at that because you'll find there are about 500 clauses. But for those that like that sort of stuff, and I've dug into it a bit, but so there will be a link on the Fresh FM Climate Matters webpage. So it wouldn't surprise me if history shows this to be a turning point in the quest for resolving the awful things we're doing to the climate and also for life in general. If that's the case, it's really a momentous week in terms of not just climate advocacy, but opening a door to a more promising future. And as we let that sink in, I think we could all do worse than reflect on how we might each lift our own personal contributions if this judicial finding has gifted us a wonderful opportunity to do something better for the future, then how are we all going to make sure we take advantage of this singular opportunity and don't just assume that other people are going to be doing it for us? Here's a little bit about how it came about. In 2019, at the University of the Pacific Islands, there was a class of law students, and their lecturer invited them to take on board an extracurricular project with a community benefit focus. The law students, I don't quite know how this dovetailed with their course, but they elected to come up with the idea that they could ask the International Court of Justice for a legal opinion to be given to the United Nations. So here's 27 law students in, I think they were in Fiji, doing something even outside their basic course, came up with this idea. They approached the Vanuatu government, and in particular, Ralph Regan Vanu, who was, I don't think he was then the climate change minister, but anyway, he was taken by their presentation. Vanuatu agreed to run with this. They wound up putting it forward to the Pacific Islands Forum. They had been supported in that previously by the Marshall Islands, but I think it was COVID that stopped it in its tracks at that time. Anyway, the Pacific Islands Forum agreed to run with it. They put it to the United Nations, and the United Nations in 2023, it's quite a story. They unanimously agreed to put it to the International Court of Justice for this advisory opinion. Now, what's remarkable about that is that all the countries of the United Nations were unanimous in pursuing that. Now, that is most unusual in the United Nations. So that in itself is quite a striking thing. So it was in 2023. In 2024, the ICJ received a very large number of submissions from different countries, an unusually large number. So again, it attracted a lot of engagement on the international stage. And in somewhat predictably, the large fossil fuel countries like Saudi Arabia, the United States, and Australia argued in one direction, but much of the rest of the world argued in the other direction. And last week at 3 p.m. European summer time, the International Court of Justice delivered its opinion. And it was a striking opinion. So that's probably just to close off there, the opinion was also remarkable in its unanimity. There are 15 judges make up the ICJ. They are from all walks of life, including from China and the US, two of the people that might be expected to resist the strong findings on climate advocacy. But the ICJ was unanimous as well. Right, so what was the ICJ asked to address? I'm going to read a little bit here because this is what the UN General Assembly put to the International Court to say, please give us your opinion on the following. Listen carefully. It's a bit of a mouthful, but it's rather important. Here we go. Quotes. Having particular regard to the Charter of the United Nations, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, the Paris Agreement, the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, the duty of due diligence, the rights recognized in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the principle of prevention of significant harm to the environment, and the duty to protect and preserve the marine environment. So that's the context that the ICJ has been asked to give regard to in responding to these following two questions with a little bit of subsection clarification. Question A, what are the obligations of states under international law to ensure the protection of the climate system and other parts of the environment from anthropogenic emissions of greenhouse gases for states and for present and future generations. So question A is, what are the obligations of states under international law with regard to the protection of the climate system? Question B, what are the legal consequences under these obligations for states where they, by their acts and omissions, have caused significant harm to the climate system and other parts of the environment affected by the adverse effects of climate change? So to unpick that part B a little bit, what are the legal consequences where states, through acts or omissions, in other words, not only things they've done, but things they've failed to do, where that's resulted in significant harm to the climate system, including to other states, harms to countries, or to harm to peoples and individuals, both present and future generations, very wide sweeping. So all of that package is what the ICJ was asked to look at. We're now going to give a quote from Antonio Guterres, who's the Director General of the United Nations, as I expect you know. This is a victory for our planet, for climate justice, and for the power of young people to make a difference. This is him talking on the findings of the ICJ. So what are the key elements of the advisory opinion? Well, I'll give a link to the full opinion. The Columbia Law School in the States has given a very good analysis, and in fact, they're mounting what they're calling a blog symposium. I will try and give a link to that, but I haven't yet found it myself. But they did quite a good analysis of it, and I wouldn't presume to be able to add anything to that. And in fact, I'll give a summary, but I hope I haven't taken too much away from it either. So here's just start with a quote from the Columbia Law School's analysis of the ICJ's advisory opinion. And I'm quoting, "The ICJ's message is clear. Climate obligations are not aspirational. They are legal, substantive, and enforceable." That has a huge ramifications for the way the world at large and some players in particular have been approaching their efforts. It was remarkable. This is again from, not quoting, but derived from the Columbia Law School's piece. It was remarkable that the ICJ reached the level of unanimity it did across, in quotes, the entire operative part of its advisory opinion. One or two of the judges did put up their own opinion on certain sections of it. All states, even those not party to any climate treaty, that's quite interesting, I'll come back to that, have a legal duty to treat the climate crisis as an urgent and existential threat, and to act and cooperate internationally to prevent present and future harm, including striving to prevent global warming exceeding 1.5 degrees C. So just as a footnote to that, I'm just adding 1.5 degrees C is not an arbitrary temperature. It's derived from science around several of the major tipping points that what are known as climate tipping points that could suddenly put some major element into a new phase that won't be reversible, such as the thawing of the Greenland ice cap, such as the thawing of the tundra, such as the possible collapse of the AMOC, the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation. So the 1.5 mentioned is not arbitrary. But anyway, let's just unpick that a little bit more. All states, even those not a party to the climate treaty, in other words, even if someone never signed up to the Paris Agreement, they are still bound by this advisory opinion on their legal obligations under international law. So that's a big thing. They've got a duty to treat the climate crisis as an urgent existential threat. So they can't just say we're going to put it back or we're going to do stuff, but later. And they have to act and cooperate internationally to prevent present and future harm. They can't just say, well, you know, this is not happening this year, so we don't have to do it. things like the tipping points I've just mentioned, when we get to the point where the West Antarctic ice sheet starts to irrecoverably melt, then that's a classic case of future harm, which will bring 3 or 4 meters of sea level rise with it. Next bullet point, I'm quoting, "The complete submergence of a territory does not necessarily negate a state's legal status." So that is basically saying, even for Pacific Islands, say the atoll islands that only have a maximum height above sea level of about 2 meters, even if they submerge completely, then they still retain their right to statehood. Now, it's a little bit ambivalent. The territory does not necessarily negate a state's legal status is a little bit like, you know, sometimes it might do, which, so the general thrust of that is welcome, but it was felt to be too ambivalent. There was an important counterview, or not a counterview, but more stringent view, under the declaration of Judge Tomka, who was one of the judges on it. Next bullet point. National duties extend beyond setting robust science-based climate plans to, and I'm quoting, regulating private actors and providing support to more vulnerable nations. Next bullet point. The opinion was integrated into what's called a comprehensive legal framework, that's the term of the Columbia Law School, including all of those different contexts that I mentioned right at the beginning of reading out what were they due to address. You know, I mentioned the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, and on human rights and so on. So the striking thing is that the opinion integrated itself with all of those so that they represented a cohesive whole rather than ones that could be picked off separately and using one to say that another doesn't count and so on. Next bullet point, we've just got this and one more. Quoting, it recognized, that is the advisory opinion from the court, recognized that a stable climate is foundational to the enjoyment of numerous rights, including the rights to life, to health, to food, to water, and to housing. And especially so, they added, for women, children, and indigenous peoples, who are all considered to be particularly vulnerable to the effects of climate change. Finally, reparations are warranted. This is quoting from the Columbia Law School. Reparations are warranted when acts or omissions can be attributed to a state. And in particular, quoting again, failure of a state to take appropriate action to protect the climate system from emissions, including through fossil fuel production, fossil fuel consumption, the granting of fossil fuel exploration licenses, or the provision of fossil fuel subsidies, may constitute an internationally wrongful act. So I've footnoted that by saying NZ, take note. Here we are promulgating the use, the opening of coal mines, the use of prospecting licenses for offshore oil deposits. We are essentially going into legally wrongful territory there, which we could be, New Zealand Inc., could be found to be needing to make reparations to people who are badly affected. To give an idea of these sort of reparations, for example, a farmer in Peru got a lot of traction suing an electricity company in Germany for the contribution to global warming, which threatened this farmer's farm because of the threats from glaciers above, thawing glaciers above the farm. Now, that case did not finally end up in the farmer's favor, but it was more on a technicality that, not that they couldn't claim against this power company, but that there was not sufficient evidence that the actual glacier was going to collapse. So lots to unpick there, but one thing is that the very wide sweeping obligations under international law and the potential for having to pay reparations or damages in different forms. Now, one of the things in that is that it was accepted that there is now sufficient science available to be able to attribute climate harms to individual states or the actions of individual states or to the actions in some cases of individual corporations and so on. So the idea of having to have blame apportioned to you was considered to be scientifically viable in a lot of situations. Quite telling there, indeed. And to give an idea of reparations, this is not just about paying money, but an example has been given, and I think we mentioned in a recent Climate Matters, that the Australian government has just granted what they call climate citizenship or climate visas to Tuvaluan Islanders who now have, they're allowing so many hundred a year, 280, I think, a year, to become, in essence, Australian citizens and relocate to Australia. That would be seen as a form of reparation. That's not how it came about in the case of Australia. It was more of a goodwill thing, but it could be seen as a form of reparation. Okay, I better keep moving. How might we look on this? Well, I'm not going to suggest I know how we should look on it, and I haven't even got my own head around it all yet at all. But here are some of my initial high-level thoughts. The court's opinion is truly astonishing in its sweep, in its clarity, in the unanimity of the judges, and it brings into sharp focus a legal landscape that for decades has been clear to the scientists researching it, but has been fogged to the public by the widespread obfuscation and misinformation distributed by others, and notably the oil companies, but not only. And it is interesting that the fossil fuel industry was singled out in the advisory opinion as being one, obviously, at the center of the issue. The overarching authoritative perspective the opinion took might well reduce divisiveness. If we take New Zealand's government, who've traditionally been, this present one, virtually like a government of climate deniers, but if they now see themselves under an international umbrella which specifically says, you might be liable for this, for example, offshore prospecting, I like to think that that gives a government like ours some breathing space in which to amend their policies, make their peace with their electorate to say, look, this is what the court has come down with. We will have to play this a bit differently. The opinion also, I hopefully, will help those of all the different people in the world say, look, we've got to just lift our game a bit to make this opportunity have real beneficial effect. I think it's hard to overstate the potential of the advisory opinion to perhaps create a sea change in behavior around the world, especially at state and corporate level. We each have a place in defending this prospect from those that would undermine it. So there will surely be people out there who will undermine it. Not least, the opinion is a testimony to the vision, enthusiasm, and commitment of a group of young people from tiny countries who didn't allow themselves to be daunted by long odds. They deserve gratitude beyond measure. I should have said more about that at the beginning, and I didn't. Astonishing that this group of 27 students have really run the gauntlet of the processes right through to the highest court in the world and have come away with a staggeringly successful advisory opinion. And now it is time to close. In closing, I just want to quote from Ralph Reganvanu. I mentioned him earlier, Vanuatu's special envoy for climate change and the environment. And he addressed in December last year, he addressed the International Court of Justice. He closed his address as follows. In closing, I choose my words carefully when I say that this may well be the most consequential case in the history of humanity. Let us not allow future generations to look back and wonder why the cause of their doom was condoned. I said I would give you a little bit on the Council's climate situation and the Council's climate strategy with the votes coming up. So today I'll talk a little bit about what the Council calls its climate lens. And for many years, it has had a so-called policy that every policy of the council will be looked at with a climate lens to see whether it stacks up for a city that is operating under a self-declared climate emergency. When you look at policy after policy, it is almost impossible to find any evidence of them having looked at it through a climate lens. There is no record of it. The policies can often be not good at all from a climate point of view, but there is nothing that seems actually to be effective. So a comment here, if you are talking to councillors about coming up for the election, one of the things maybe to say is, how are you going to make sure that council does a better job using its climate lens to get climate-friendly policies out there? Okay, now on that note, this is Lindsay Wood thanking you for your company. Climate Matters is brought to you by Fresh FM, the top of the South's community access radio station. Fresh FM broadcasts in Blenheim on 88.9, to Eastern Golden Bay on 95.0, to the Nelson CBD on 107.2, and across the Nelson-Tasman region on 104.8. It's also streamed to the planet on freshfm.co.nz, and podcasts of Climate Matters and of other locally produced shows are available through freshfm.co.nz. So we're running well over time. I'm going to now thank you for your company. I hope I enjoy it again next week. And kia kaha for the climate.
The podcast you just listened to was a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast on Fresh FM, with support from New Zealand On Air. Fresh FM is a community access media station based in Te Tauihu, the top of the South Island, New Zealand. The funding of Access Media makes these podcasts possible. To find similar programs by other community access media stations, go online to accessmedia.nz. If you or your group would like to know more about how you can have a program on our station, please contact us. Visit our website, freshfm.net, for our contact details.